Chapter 17. Into the fires of battle, unto the anvil of war. The Sulphur Commercia district had been a bastion of militia reserves and a strong point for the dock's anti-air defences. The few turrets that remained atop buildings, both automated and manned, fell silent. Around them, the district burned. Above them, Orc fighters and bombers dropped their payloads with abandon, barely held in check even when the defence turrets were operational. Sulphur Commercia, as a trading hub for the western docks that was always densely populated in times of peace, was home to a particularly large concentration of above-ground storm shelters, most of which were already broken by the besieging Orcs. The enemy advance was at a standstill in this section of the dockyards, not because of Imperial resistance, but because there was so much blood to shed and so much to destroy. To leave the area devoid of life and in utter ruin meant the aliens had to linger here, slaying with wild joy in their feral eyes. When writing of the siege in a personal journal some years after the war, Major Lasus of the 61st Steel Legion lamented the unbelievable loss of life that occurred with the dock breaches, citing the destruction of the Sulphur Commercia as among the bloodiest events in the Hell's Reach siege, which no man, no tank battalion, no legion of titans could have dreamed of preventing. The trading concourse retained little of its former grandeur. While warehouses were less in evidence here, the houses of the wealthy mercantile families of Hell's Reach burned just as well, and those citizens that had elected to remain in their homes rather than seek out the subterranean municipal shelters now fell to the same fate as the civilians trapped in the cracked-open storm shelters. The aliens descended without mercy, and no contingent of house guards, no matter how well trained they were capable of defending their lord's estates against the Xenos tide that swarmed the docks districts. The most notable defence, one that captured the spirit of defiance surging throughout the hive's stunted propaganda machine, was not, as might be suspected, the one that inflicted greatest harm upon the enemy. The estate defence that did the most damage, numerically speaking, was performed by the House Farwellian Constabulary, employed for 7 generations by the noble Farwell bloodline. Their extended survival wasn't quite the soul-lifting story that Commissar Falkoff and Colonel Sarin were seeking, as the esteemed House Farwell were, in truth, considered decadent pigs in the public eye, and its various scions were no strangers to political scandal, financial investigation, and rumours of trade double-dealing. In short, they performed so well in this district war because they had shrewdly cheated their way to immense wealth and had a standing army of 600 soldiers at their beck and call. A standing army that, it was noted in Imperial records, the Farwells refused to lend to the defence of the docks or the city's militia. This sizable force was also their bane. As words flashed through the Orcish ranks that there was a nexus of defence formed at the House Farwell compound, the aliens stormed it en masse, ending the tenacious resistance and the bloodline itself. The most notable defence, as stated, was a far cry from this exercise in doomed selfishness. House Tarasine, with only 5 off-world mercenaries hired as protection, defended their modest estate through a series of guerrilla strikes and automated security traps for 19 hours. Although their home was destroyed by the invaders, 7 family members emerged unscathed in the days after the dock battle, leaving them in a relatively strong position for the rebuilding of the city, with Lord Helios Tarasine's 4 daughters suddenly pursued with great vigour by weakened and heirless noble bloodlines. At shelter CC-46, one of the few shelters still intact as the second day of the dock war stretched on, annihilation was averted at the very last moment. The first drop pod came down with a thunderbolt's force, striking into the roadway leading to the front doors of the sanctuary dome. The orc rabble that had been clamouring in the street was thrown into disarray, and several of the beasts were incinerated in the pod's retroburst, or crushed beneath its hammering weight. The pod's sides blasted open, slamming down into descent ramps which pulverized the beasts that had recovered enough to start beating their axe blades against the green hull. Across the docks, several more pods rained down, their arrival mirroring the destruction unleashed by the first. With bolters raised, crashing out round after round, and flamers breathing dragon's breath in hissing gouts of chemical fire, the salamanders joined their Templar brothers in defense of Hive Hell's Reach.
"We are 70 in number," he says to me.
"Seven squads." His name is Vareth, a sergeant of the Salamander's 6th Company. Before I speak, he says something both humbling and unexpectedly respectful.
"I am honored to fight at your side, Reclusiarch Grimaldus."
This confession throws me, and I am not certain I keep my surprise from my voice when I reply. "The Templars are in your debt, but tell me, brother, why have you come?" Around us, my knights and Vareth's warriors stalk among the dead and the dying, slaying wounded orcs with sword thrusts to exposed throats. The stormtrooper and his dock workers follow suit, using the bayonets of their rifles. Vareth disengages his helm seals and lifts it clear. Even having served with the salamanders before, it is difficult to look upon one of the sons of Nocturne and feel nothing at all. The gene seed of their Primarch reacts to their homeworld's viciously radioactive surface. The pigmentation of Vareth's skin is the same charcoal black as every unhelmeted warrior of the chapter I've ever seen. His eyes lack pupils and irises. Instead, Vareth stares out at the world around us through orbs of ember red, as if blood has filled his eye sockets and discolored his eyes in the process. His true voice is a low oral embodiment of the igneous rock that leaves the surface of his homeworld dark, barren, and grey. It is all too easy to see how these warriors came from a world of lava rivers and volcanic mountain ranges that turn the sky black.
"We were the last of the salamanders in orbit. The Lord of the Fireborn called us to him, and we obeyed."
I am familiar with the title. I have heard their chapter master referred to by this name many times before. "Master Tushan, may the Emperor continue to favor him, fights far from here, brother. The salamanders bleed the enemy many leagues to the east, and the Hemlock River runs black with alien blood." Vareth inclines his head in a solemn nod, and his red-eyed gaze rises to take in the shelter dome at the end of this very street.
"This is so, and it gladdens me to know my brothers fight well enough to earn such words from you, Reclusiarch. The Lord of the Fireborn makes his stand with the war engines of Legios Ignatum and Invigilata."
"So answer my question, for time is not our ally. Hell's Reach burns. Will you stay? Will you fight with us?"
"We will not stay. We cannot stay."
I bite back the wrath that rises from disappointment, and the salamander continues.
"We are the 70 warriors chosen to make planetfall here, and stand with you until the docks are held. My lord and master heard of the assured civilian devastation in the fall of the city's coastal districts."
"Few messages reach the ears of our allies elsewhere in the world. Few messages from them reach us."
"The salamanders were not blind to your plight, honored Reclusiarch. Master Tushan heard. We are his blade, his will, to ensure the survival of the city's most innocent souls."
"And then you will leave."
"And then we will leave. Our fight is along the banks of the Hemlock. Our glory is there."
This gesture alone is enough to earn my eternal gratitude. For the first time in decades, emotion steals the words I wish to voice. This is all we needed. This is salvation. We can hurt them now. I remove my own helm, breathing in the first taste of Hell's Reach's sulfuric air in weeks, months. Vareth inhales deeply, doing the same.
This city,
he smiles, teeth white against his onyx features.
It smells like home.
The heated wind feels good on my skin. I offer my hand to Vareth, and he grips my wrist, an alliance between warriors. Thank you, I tell him, meeting his inhuman eyes.
If you are needed elsewhere.
Vareth matches my gaze with his own.
Then go to your duty, honored Reclusiac. We stand with you for now, and together we will not let these docks fall.
First, tell me of the Orbital War. What news of the Crusader?
The deadlock remains. It grieves me to say this, but it is so. We are shattering the enemy battle by battle, but it is like hurling fire at stone. Little is achieved against such an overwhelming foe. It will take weeks before your High Marshal dares a full assault to reclaim the heavens. He is a shrewd warrior. My brothers and I were honored to serve with him in the fleet.
To hear his words is like a lifeline, a connection to existence beyond the broken walls of this accursed city. I press him for more. What of Tempestus Hive? They suffered as we did.
Fallen. Lost to the enemy. Its forces in retreat. The last word from any remnant of command structure was that the city was being abandoned, and its retreating survivors were making their way overland to connect with the guard regiments serving alongside my lord and master.
Scattered defense forces and guard units crossing hundreds of kilometers of wasteland. Such tenacity was to be admired. This world will never recover, that much is clear. Fatalism may not be bred into my bones, but there is no valor in living a lie. What we do here is defiance, the selling of life as dearly as possible. We are not fighting to win, but waging war out of spite. This salamander, brother though he may be, has a destiny beyond this city. I relent to it. Coordinate the dispersal of squads with Sergeant Bastilan. Focus your efforts on the westernmost districts, where the bulk of storm shelters are to be found. Bastilan will provide you with the required vox frequencies to connect with the stormtroopers leading the civilian defenses. Do not expect clarity in communications. Many of the city's vox relay towers have fallen.
It will be done, Reclusiac.
For the Emperor. I release Vareth's wrist. His reply is a curious one, betraying his chapter's unique focus.
For the Emperor,
he says,
and his people.
Jurizion, master of the forge and knight of the Emperor, threw his head back and laughed. He had not laughed in many years, for he was not a soul given to humor. What he was seeing now, however, struck him as immensely funny. So he laughed, without meaning to. The sound echoed throughout the immense chamber, resounding off metal-reinforced walls of stone and the hulking adamantium shape that stretched for 50 meters into the darkness. The Ordinatus Armageddon. Oberon. Jurizion's armor had been the only sound in the chamber for hours, the overlaid ceramite plating clacking and whirring as he moved around the great weapon. He'd circled it several dozen times, staring, scanning, taking in every detail with his own eyes and his warplate's Auspex sensors. It was, without question, the most beautiful creation he had ever laid his augmetic eyes upon. In aesthetics, perhaps it would not appeal to a poet or a painter, but that was hardly the point. In power, it would appeal to any general in the Imperium. It was a triumph of design and intent, a glorious success in mankind's quest to master a greater ability to destroy its enemies. The great construct consisted of a strong three-sectioned base that held up a weapons platform on gantries and struts. Atop the platform was the weapon itself. Jurizion considered each aspect of the war machine in turn, silent in its deactivation. From the front, Oberon was as wide as two bulky Land Raider battle tanks side by side. Its length was 50 meters in total, giving it the appearance of a land train, long and segmented. Immense, to say the least, it was of approximate size to a towering battle titan lying on its back. The war machine's base was divided into three sections: a helm segment, the drive module with a reinforced cockpit chamber, a thorax section next, pinned under the weight of massive metal stanchions, and lastly, an abdomen segment, bearing the same weight as the section before. Each of these base sections was bulked up further by side-mounted power generators, shielded behind yet more armor plating. These, Jurizion knew, were the gravitational suspensor generators. Anti-gravitational technology on such a scale was no longer heard of in the Imperium, except for the deployment of war machines of this caliber. These generators' rarity made them the most precious thing on the entire planet, bar nothing. The stanchions and gantries supported the colossal weapons platform, which in turn housed dozens of square meters of energy pods, fusion chambers, and magnetic field generators. It was as if an industrial manufactorum had been installed on the back of a column of tanks. These generators would, if active, supply power to the land train's weapon mount, a tower of a cannon forged of heat-shielded ceramite and joined to the forward power generators. Coolant vents ran the length of the cannon like reptilian scales. Like parasitic worms, nests of secondary power feed cables hung from the barrel, while industrial support claws held the weapon in place. A Nova cannon. A weapon used by starships to end one another across the immensity of the void. Here it was, mounted on priceless and infinitely armored anti-gravitational technology from a forgotten age.
"Titan killer," the Master of the Forge whispered.
Jurizion reverently stroked his gloved fingertips down the drive section's metallic skin, feeling the thick armor plating, the chunky rivets, down to the minuscule differences in the layers of adamantium, the tiniest variations and imperfections from its forging process hundreds of years before. He'd withdrawn his hand, and that was when he'd laughed. Oberon, the death of Titans. It was real. It was here. And it was his. He gained access to the forward command module through a ladder leading to a bulkhead that required opening manually. Once inside the powerless cockpit chamber, Jurizion spared a glance for the winches, levers, and black, blank screens along the drive console. It was all new, all alien to him, but nothing he considered beyond his intuition and mechanicus training. Another bulkhead barred his way to the second module. With the Ordinatus powered down, this one also required him to manually turn the iron wheel on its surface. The door squealed open with the reluctance of an unused airlock. Jurizion's gaze pierced the blackness beyond with aid from his helm's vision filters. It was confined and claustrophobic, despite there being little in the module beyond armored pods fixed to the walls that housed the power generators for the anti-grav lifters, and crew ladders leading up into the main generatorium on the platform above. Jurizion ascended, opening another two bulkheads as he rose through the support gantries. The innards of the platform top generatorium were familiar enough in their cluttered industrial layout. He stood within the heart of a spaceship's weapon system, condensed to offer less range and power, but on a more manoeuvrable and manageable scale. The projectiles from this sacred cannon didn't, after all, have to travel across thousands of kilometers of open space to strike a target. It was, bluntly speaking, the sawn-off shotgun of Nova cannon technology. The notion brought a smile to Jurizion's mirthless lips. It took a further 3 hours of investigation, feed checks, and generator testing to ascertain whether the Ordinatus Armageddon could be reactivated, and how such a feat could be achieved. The result, at the close of the investigations, was a bittersweet one. This weapon of war should have been crewed by dozens of specialist Skitarii, magi and tech adepts, born and raised for this purpose above all others. It should have been ritually blessed by the Lord of the Centurio Ordinatus and its newest duty inscribed upon its hull alongside the 93 prayers of reawakening. Instead of the chanting and worship due to the spirit of such a war engine, the soul of Oberon awoke in silence and darkness. Its vague, reforming consciousness did not detect a gestalt host of abased Centurio Ordinatus minds supplicating themselves for its attention, but a single other soul in union with its own. This soul was strong, ironclad and dominant. It identified itself as Jurisian. In the drive module, his brain, spine, and body armor, linked via telemetry cables to the interface feeds in the Princeps throne, the Master of the Forge closed his eyes. Around him, the systems flared into life. Scanners chimed as they began to see again. Overhead lights flickered and held at low illumination settings. With a great shudder, and the accompanying thrumming of power generators coming back to life, all three modules shook once, twice, and jolted hard. In the drive section, Jurisian lurched in his seat. He hadn't jolted forward, but up. 5 meters up. There the modules remained, cradled on a pulsing anti-grav field that distorted the ground below with something that was, and was not, a heat shimmer.
Activation phase one.
The war machine's voice issued from vox speakers around the command module. Beneath the mechanical tone seethed a roiling, uncoiling hatred. Jurisian bowed his head in respect, but did not cease his work.
My brothers call me to Hell's Reach.
He spoke into the cold control pod, expecting no answer and receiving none.
And though that may mean nothing, I know that war calls to you.
Through the interface connection, the spirit of Oberon growled, the sound inhuman and untranslatable. Jurisian nodded.
I thought so.
Asa Van Tortellius lingered over a single phrase. He had no idea how to describe just how cold he was. Around him, the deserted cathedral still bore more than its share of wall scars and battle damage. On a fallen block of masonry, the acolyte composed his memoirs of the Hell's Reach War, while the great titan pitched slowly forward and back in the rough rhythm of walking. Occasionally, air pressure and gravity would exert themselves on his left or right side, as Storm Herald rounded a corner. As he had done for years, Asavan ignored these things. The ruined cathedral around him was altogether harder to ignore. It still appeared much as it had over 30 days ago, when the alien brutes had brought the god machine to its knees. The statues still lay as alabaster corpses in broken face-down repose, limbs cracked off to lie several meters distant. The walls were still decorated by gunfire holes and ugly cracks that cobwebbed outwards from impact points. The stained glass windows, his only succor from the irritation of the shield above, were still gaping holes in the war-blackened architecture, as unpleasant to look upon as missing teeth in the smile of a saint. Day in, day out, Asavan sat in the lonely, contemplative quiet of the cathedral, and composed what he knew full well were poorly worded poems commemorating the coming victory in Hive Hell's Reach. He would destroy well over half of what he wrote, sometimes wincing as he reread the words he'd brought into being. But of course, there was no one else to witness them. Not here. The cathedral had stood almost empty since it had been besieged. The Templars had come, in purity protecting us, in wrath indefatigable, Asavan had written, before deleting the cringe-worthy words forever. But they had come too late to do much more than preserve the wounded, hollow bones of Storm Herald's monastery. Weeks had passed since. Weeks during which nothing had changed. Nothing had been repaired. Asavan was one of the few people still living in the cathedral. His fellows consisted mainly of servitors, hard-wired into the battlement turrets, slaved to the targeting and reloading systems along the walls. He saw these wretches often, because it had become his duty to keep them alive. The lobotomized, augmented once-humans were little more than limbless and slack-jawed automatons, installed in life-support cradles next to their turret cannons, and had no means to sustain their own existences. Several had lost their feed-waste bio-connection cables, with the damage taken in the siege. And even all these weeks later, the remaining magi in Storm Herald's main body had not reached repairs so minor on the long list of abuses in need of correcting. Key systems took priority, and few enough Mechanicus adepts remained alive as it was. The fighting had been fierce below as well. So it fell to Asavan, as one of the few cathedral survivors, to spoon-feed these mindless creatures with soft, protein-rich paste in order to keep them from dying, and flush their waste filters once a week. He did this not because he was ordered to, or because he particularly cared about the continuing functionality of the handful of battlement cannons that were still unscathed. He did it because he was bored, and because he was lonely. It was the second week when he started talking to the unresponsive servitors. By the fourth, they all had names and backstories. At first, Asavan had sought to order one of the seven medial servitors still patrolling the cathedral to perform these actions, but their programming was cripplingly limited. One was monotasked with walking from room to room, broom in hand, sweeping up any dust from the boots of the faithful. Well, there were no faithful anymore. And the servitor had no broom. Asavan had known the servitor before his augmentation as a particularly dull-witted acolyte that earned his fate for stealing coins from his lay brothers. His punishment was to be rendered into a bionic slave, and Asavan had shed no tears at the time. Still, it was no joy to see the simple creature stagger from chamber to chamber, clacking the broken end of a brushless broomstick against the rubble-strewn ground, never getting closer to cleaning up the mess, and unable to rest until its duty was done. It refused orders to cease work, and Asavan suspected what was left of its mind had been broken at some point during the battle, an unnoticed head wound, perhaps. 6 weeks in, the servitor had collapsed in the middle of a row of broken pews, its human parts no longer able to function without rest. Asavan had done with it as he'd done with all of the slain. He and the handful of survivors threw the body overboard. A morbid curiosity, and one that he always regretted afterwards, compelled him to watch as the bodies fell 50 meters to rupture on the ground below. Asavan took no thrill or amusement from such sights, but found he could never look away. In work he quickly erased, he confessed to himself that seeing the bodies fall was a means of reminding himself he was still alive. Whatever the truth of the situation, the sights gave him nightmares. He wondered how soldiers could get used to such things, and why they would ever want to. His main concern this past week was the cold. With the Titan committed to battle for this prolonged engagement, the damage it had sustained in the ambush weeks ago was forever being repaired, compensated for, and re-aggravated by new war wounds sustained in the conflict. The command crew, "Blessings be upon them as they lead us to triumph," Asavan still whispered, were drawing ever-increasing maintenance attention and power from secondary systems throughout the Titan. Minor systems went unrepaired by the adept tech teams that were already spread thin throughout the gigantic construct, and dealing with the vital systems. Some systems even went powerless as energy feeds were drained and disconnected, their thrumming fuel flooded to the plasma cells used to power the shield and the main weapons. A week ago, the heating systems to the cathedral had been drained to the point of no longer functioning. With typical Mechanicus efficiency, there were secondary and tertiary fallback options in the case of such a development. Unfortunately for Asavan and the few acolytes left alive up there, both the secondary and tertiary contingencies were lost. The secondary fallback had been a smaller, self-sustaining generator that fed itself from a power source reserve that was linked to nothing else and could therefore never be drained for other purposes. The generator was now no more than scrap metal in the ruined mess that had once been the cathedral's maintenance deck. The generator's destruction also annihilated the tertiary contingency plan, which was for four mono-tasked servitors, good for nothing else, to be activated and set to turn the generator's manual pumps by hand. Even if the generator had been fully functional, all four of the servitors were killed in the battle 5 weeks ago. Asavan had gamely tried to turn the first of the hand cranks himself, but lacking a servitor's strength meant all he achieved was a sore back. The crank never moved a centimetre. So now, here he sat, on a fallen pillar, trying to compose something to describe how bone-achingly cold he was, and how bone-achingly cold he had been for the last 6 days. In place of organs, Storm Herald possessed a generator core of intensely radioactive and fusion-hot plasma. Asavan found it a curious paradox that the heart of a sun was hermetically sealed and insulated many decks below him, yet here he was, on the edge of freezing to death. These were the kinds of observations that he would write down, and then destroy in shame at daring to complain, while so many innocent imperial souls were out there in the burning city, dying moment by moment. It was in that moment Asavan Tortellius decided he would change fate himself. He would not freeze to death on the Titan's back in this hollow monastery, nor would he gripe about the cold while thousands of deserving and loyal people died in their droves. His fellow acolytes had never been kind to him regarding his intelligence, but people could say what they wished about his wits, slow or otherwise. Asavan liked to believe he always arrived at the right answer eventually. And now he had. Yes, it was time to make a difference to the people of Hell's Reach. It was time to leave the Titan.